Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on October 17, 2012, during a live teleform conference call. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleform conference call on patent rights. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please remember that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to welcome to our discussion today return guests Professor Richard Epstein and Professor Adam Mossoff of George Mason University. And we're going to do things a little bit differently today than we normally would. Professor Mossoff is going to lead the discussion, posing a series of questions to Professor Epstein after his opening remarks, after which we'll then turn to the audience for your questions. I mentioned that Professor Mossoff is from George Mason University Law School. There he teaches in various areas of property and intellectual property rights. His fuller bio is available on our website, so I'm not going to introduce him any further other than to mention that he's written one of the most fascinating law review articles I've ever read on the sewing machine wars and how those many different owners of patents for individual component parts of the first sewing machine came together to cooperatively to ultimately make the first sewing machine. But with that, Professor Mossoff, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here today and to be leading our digital version of a fireside chat with Professor Richard Epstein. Richard Epstein is currently the Peter and Christian Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and is the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at New York University Law School. And lastly, he remains a senior lecturer at the University of Chicago. In fact, when I was a student at the University of Chicago many years ago, I had the distinct honor of having Professor Epstein be my patent law professor, from whom I learned very much about patent law and have continued to explore the issues that he first made me very interested in that class. So it's a delight to have you here. Welcome, Richard.
Well, it's good to be here. I think you ought to give them the title of the presentation because I always forget it has something to do whether or not patent law is a spur or a drag on the economy. Is it something like that?
Oh, yes. The topic of our talk today is patent rights, a spark or hindrance for the economy. Our format will be that Richard will speak for about 5 to 10 minutes to give an overview of his views. We'll then approximately have about 10 minutes of a dialogue between Richard and me, where I will pose some questions to him. And then we will open it up to the audience attending this teleform for them to ask their questions directly to Richard for the rest of the teleform. So without much further ado, I know you all want to hear Richard, so take it away, please.
Oh, thank you. And first, I'd like to say when I taught Adam, it was not only the first time I taught patent law, but it was the only time I've ever taught patent law. So for 11 years, I've been wandering in the wilderness. And this has a lot to do with the way in which I think about the subject. There are two kinds of people who get involved in patent law. There are those who are fascinated by patents as such, know the statutes, know the inventions, work from inside the system, and try to understand the way in which it puts together. I came at it in quite a different way. I was, for many years, a person who worked in property and dealt with all of its forms. That would include land and water, spectrum, and all sorts of other things. And so my understanding of the system asked the question, how do you draw analogies to and relationships between these various kinds of areas? And the basic point of my approach is probably summarized in this following way, which is, the basic system of property law that we have out there for land and for chattels has worked pretty well for countless generations. And the issue is, how is it that we best carry it over into an area of intellectual property law so as to keep all of its desirable features and to try to eliminate any peculiar undesirable features that arise by virtue of this transition? And so for the basic understanding, property rights generally give you the right to possess, the right to exclude, the right to use, the right to dispose, the right to develop. That's the way in which you think about it with land. That's about the way in which you ought to think about it with respect to patent. And that in turn sort of entails the situation that you have strong rights of protection, normally through injunctive relief, which puts cases like eBay against Merck Exchange into question, and generally speaking would favor free and complicated rules on alienations, whereby, unless there were antitrust restrictions, party could do more or less what they want with their assets. Those rules, of course, have been called into question by cases like Quanta and LG Electronics. The key difference between the patent system and the rest of the world has to do with the durability of the interest. When you privatize land or a chattel, the right to exclude should, I think, presumptively be in perpetuity, because there's no advantage that you could find by opening the thing up again so that somebody else could take exclusive possessory rights. But that's not the situation with intellectual property. There, once you open it up, the good, the information that is embodied in the invention, is in fact available to just about anybody on any terms. And so what happens is you now have greater dissemination because you've eliminated the monopoly profit that the patent holder could charge against all users. You don't open them up on the first day, of course, because if you did that, you'd never get these inventions. So a problem that you have with patent law is to make the period of exclusivity long enough so as to allow a suitable return and short enough to make sure that it doesn't become essentially a super excessive rate of return. We've hit upon 17 years. We've made adjustments on that before. It's a hard call. There's some people who think it should be this or that, longer or shorter. I'm not going to battle that question here. The usual battle with respect to patents comes from a very different source, which is whether or not the blockade rights that are created by patents are sufficiently dangerous that one has to soften the system. And I think in many cases what you see are all sorts of people who come up with the argument that a patent is in fact the way to deter innovation so that the release of various kinds of technologies or information from the patent system is probably going to be a good thing. This argument started early on, about 15 years ago almost now, in connection with pharmaceutical products, where it was held that certain kinds of key patents would create bottlenecks, would generate an anti-commons where all the people who had to get together in order to make some kind of an invention to work would be unable to do so, so that valuable technologies would languish because of patent disputes. In the initial pharmaceutical context, I think that claim was basically overwrought. You're trying to find particular instances of drugs which had foundered because of those issues, and you discover that, generally speaking, the market worked fairly well, and that you could not point to cases where anybody would say certain technologies were left on the cutting room floor because of the blockades. In some cases, a patentee will turn a blind eye to somebody who's going to develop a complementary technology which will increase the value of his patent, so that's fine. And in other cases, there are various devices like patent pools and cross-licenses which will, in fact, deal with the subject. And then in other cases, certain ways in which you tweak the remedial structure so as to delay automatic injunctive relief to give somebody a chance to invent around the patent would work as well. In more recent years, we've had exactly the same argument take place in connection with business method patents on the one hand, and with respect to software patents on the other, where it has been held that the intrusive nature of these patents is sufficiently broad that one is better off doing without them. When I was in a recent debate with Tim Yu, who was at Columbia Law School, what he said was that he thought that the current system of patent law with respect to both business method and with software patents was kind of like a parasite on the market. It didn't kill the host, but it slowed it down. And my reaction is, if you see industries growing the way in which the software industry has grown, give me some of that parasite so that I can do the same thing. One just thinks of the fact that 5 years ago, BlackBerry was the industry standard, dominant forever, and now it is basically exposed to ridicule because virtually it's dropped a third or fourth on the distribution list. You look at the rate of technological progress between then and now, it just doesn't seem in any way, shape, or form to have been slowed down. So it seems to me that in the face of rapid technological advance, to say that the current system is a disaster is a mistake. Now, this doesn't mean that I'm in favor of all the system. Many people have pointed out, and I'll end on this note, that sometimes you spend $20 billion a year litigating patents. The question is, it's a number. What do you make of the number? And here are a couple things to make of it. One is you've got to figure out what the denominator is. What is the total value of patentable assets over which that becomes the litigation figure? And if that is in the hundreds of billions of dollars, all of a sudden the figure doesn't look so large. The second point is, why do we have these numbers? And in many cases, it seems to me that the answer is that the numbers go in this particular direction, not because we have tough patent rules, but because we've changed the system in ways for the worse. The most conspicuous illustration of that is it's now very difficult for a licensor of non-exclusive licenses to get injunctive relief against people who infringe the patent. This encourages all sorts of systematic infringement, which increases uncertainty and litigation costs, because now it pays for somebody to think very long and hard about opting out of the consensual system and going into the infringement system where they may be better off than they were before. Once one company does that and succeeds, other companies can do it, and you'll see the patent system unravel. So So it may well be, in effect, that the costs are too high, but it could well be that the reason they're too high in many cases is not because we have basically too many patents blocking the way. It's that the patents that we do have are too weak, leading to widespread defections from the voluntary system. So in general, my view about this is that what you want to do when you correct patents is not to start with some holistic denunciation of the system writ large, but to figure out some particular point that's wrong and to correct it. And the effort to do that, by and large, with the American Invents Act, a propagandistic title for what I think is a statute that's largely opposed by inventors, shows the danger of comprehensive legislative reform. That statute has a lot of ad hoc definitions. It has a lot of additional procedures. It raises separation of powers problems, res judicata problems, and so forth. And at the minimum, creates a dual system of administration as the old patents linger on for another 10 years at least, or maybe even 15, or perhaps even longer with respect to resales and litigation. At the same time, you have to master a new system. Trying to run two of these things side by side does not strike me as the prudent way of organizing a system. And with that, Adam, I'm willing to take any sling and arrow that you wish to hurl in my direction.
Excellent. Thank you, Richard. One of the issues that seems to be running throughout your comments is that the patent system serves two different functions, both to incentivize the creation of new inventions and then to provide the mechanisms, both legal and market, to commercialize those inventions and turn them into innovation. Now, within the patent community at the moment, there tends to be a split between people who think that the patent system reduces to either one or either of those policy goals. Do you see the patent system as reflecting those policy goals, both of them, or one of them?
Well, it seems to me that what you're trying to do is to maximize some level of social welfare, by which we mean figure out what the largest rate of return from the kinds of resources that we put in investigation and research and development. And so long as you know that there's a trade-off and that both of these values are persistent and long-lasting, the idea that you would get the maximum of the whole by driving yourself to one corner or the other seems to be wrong. I don't think anybody who's seriously interested in innovation would say, you know what we really have to do is to make all patents of infinite life, because that way you're going to have the greatest spur to innovation. And on the other hand, I think, in effect, if somebody says we want ready commercialization, then you can put everything in the public domain and you don't have to pay anything for it, and you save all the licensing costs that would otherwise exist. And I don't think that anybody would really want to defend that position. So at that point, we're all in the same soup, having to figure out what that middle position turns out to be. And my view about it is that, you know, with respect to patents, the 17-year term seems about appropriate. In some cases, it actually seems a little bit short. So with pharmaceutical drugs, when a lot of that time is lost in Hatch-Waxman-Hell, because you have to spend so much time getting the thing to market through the FDA, 11 years of exclusivity doesn't strike me as long enough, and I would want to add some time to it. With respect to software patents, most of them lose most of their value relatively quickly, so they may be useful for 4 or 5 years. And there the key feature is to make sure that the system records them very quickly so they don't wither on the vine before they gain some sort of approval. And one of the real reforms I think that we need is that, given that the amount of business that goes through the PTO today has increased radically, the resources that are devoted to making sure that various airplanes get off the runways means that you have to put more money on the public side to match the increased investment on the private side. But in terms of either or, I think that would be a terrible mistake. Everybody's always understood it was a trade-off. The guy who understood it best of all was Giles Rich, who put together the 1952 Act with a team of professionals and did it in a very low-key and effective fashion. You know, it seems to me that 60 years later, we knew less than we did before.
Okay, and I'd like to ask maybe one or two more kind of foundational questions, and then maybe if we have time, ask a question more, some questions more about the weeds, and then we can get to audience questions if there are any.
Okay, that's fine.
You began your remarks by integrating property theory and how we conceptualize property and how we normally justify property, and then how that extends over into the IP realm, which you've developed quite well in some of your writings on IP, especially your article in the Yale Law Journal on old boundaries and new frontiers. Can you maybe say something on the point that is often made that I heard repeatedly made in a congressional briefing just this past week that I participated in, that, well, IP is not property, and that, you know, it's something special or unique or unusual, and that people typically point to the Constitution, the fact that it's in the Constitution, as an example of this. Could you possibly respond to that in some way, shape, or form?
and basically a dreamy and ineffective answer for what's going on. And let's just start. First of all, you mentioned the Constitution, and there are two ways that you could look at the patent law. One is respect is an inchoate body, which tells you in the future how various patents are to be created. And, of course, with respect to those not yet in existence, there's a very broad degree of government discretion as to how the system will operate. And generally speaking, what happens is people are quite rational in that state of the mind because there's no patents out there to confiscate. And so, therefore, you have to basically do the trade-off behind the veil of ignorance, and you got to get them in there, and then you have to make sure they don't last in perpetuity so that the basic general law works pretty well. The situation is very different once you have existing patents out there, and then somebody tries to change their attributes, to shorten them, to exclude certain things from them, and so forth. And in those cases, the only way to understand the system is to treat it exactly as though it's a form of property. That's what the case law says, and that's what ought to be done. So, for example, some years ago, I worked on several pieces of godforsaken legislation, the so-called Check 21 Act. My client was Data Treasury, which had all the patents on this, and then there was a very profound bill introduced by the banks which said, oh, we know that you've got valid patents out there, but the only thing we wish to do is to change some of the remedies. We won't give you damages, we won't give you injunctive relief, and we won't give you attorney's fees for suing. So essentially, you allow the banks to use your imaging system free of charge, and you could charge the credit card companies for what they do. And we beat that back on the grounds that what it was a taking of the thing in question. And it wasn't a mere regulation like the Penn Central test would govern. It was an actual occupation and use of the patent in question for which the per se rules carried over from Loretto, the case where you put the little box on top of the on the roof, is a much more accurate situation. So not only did we start talking about them as property, but we could make, in dealing with the constitutional issue, the exact same distinction that you make with respect to tangible properties between restrictions on use and occupation, or in fact use by the government. Now, this is not to say that I like that distinction. I think Penn Central is one of the worst decisions in the history of Western civilization. But my only point here is whether it's a good or a bad decision, it translates extremely well into this other area, and we were able to beat back that legislation. Looking more generally, it seems to me that, well, you have to first ask yourself what property is. And, you know, there's a lot of dispute in the literature about the salience of the bundle of rights situations, but I think as a first approximation, it's still a useful tool. And what you say with respect to land is you identify a plot of land by meets and bounds. You then mention its spatial dimensions from the bottom of the earth to the top of the heavens. Then what you do is you worry about the divisions that take place in that property by way of leases and licenses and so forth. And then you worry about transfer and about protection against externals. What happens is a patent is basically like a 20-year piece in property without the reversion, and you give it compact protection. Interestingly enough, it's actually a simpler system of property rights in one regard than land, because given the short duration, there's no reason whatsoever to create life estates and contingent remainders with respect to patents, even if you were allowed to do so. It's much more coherent. Secondly, you don't have all the physical interaction problems associated with nuisance law, live and let live kinds of doctrines and so forth, because physical interference in the patent space is almost never really an important kind of issue. And third, you also have all of the kinds of privileges issues as to when, for example, the government could swoop in and take somebody's patented medicine because it has to deal with a plague, which is very much like the kind of public necessity cases that you have with respect to the land in question. So if you look at all of these things, what happens is there's no reason why you can't carry the analogies over, and that means when you're talking about infringement, you cross the borderline, we can enjoin you on the one hand and force you to pay damages on the other, unless you show a privilege. And when you're dealing with the injunctions, you should remember that in cases of land, the standard rule is that the injunction may be delayed a little bit to allow the defendant to close down his affairs or to organize them in some efficient way, and you can have exactly the same level of discretion, no more or less, when you start dealing with the kinds of patents. So as a theoretical matter, the translations work extremely well, and to sort of argue that somehow or other you start on an ad hoc basis with this stuff has the terrible disadvantage is it doesn't tell you what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to start up. If you abandon the property comparisons, you have to begin somewhere else, and almost invariably the people who take this position don't understand how powerful the translations turn out to be, And furthermore, they have a very different agenda because they want the patent system not to look like a coherent system of rights, but to look like a bunch of green and moldy cheese with lots of holes in the middle of it. So I think you will never find anybody on the patent protective side of the debate, which I surely am, and you are as well, who would ever want to sort of take this other characterization. And I think it's actually somewhat disingenuous to try to disarm the strongest debate or the strongest arguments in the debate by asserting without any real conceptual foundations that there are no differences between systems. The last point one would want to make is also property rights are kind of complicated in yet another way. Land is the dominant paradigm, and it works very well with patents. But in certain kinds of cases, there are other sorts of issues, like with water rights and so forth, where the issues are more correlative and more communal. And I think the challenge would be to show me what it is about the patent system, which would mean that you have to move to a multi-access system like riparian rights. And at that point, the contrasts dominate the comparisons. So one can say, not that water rights are misconceived because they don't look like land rights, but rather water rights are well-conceived, but patent rights don't look very much like them.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to take us back to that green and moldy cheese with holes in it for a moment.
Oh, you like my English, thank you.
and actually take us back a little further in your remarks. We referred to your fight over the Check 21 bill and the financial services patents because they seem to have responded to your successful efforts by that by, of course, changing their approach to how they dealt with these patents.
Yes.
Instead of removing the ability to obtain any remedies for the violation of their rights, put into Section 18 in the American Vents Act additional procedures for the banks to invalidate these patents. And so can you comment perhaps on that and run around your argument and how this got incorporated into the American Vents Act?
Sure. I mean, look, first of all, let me explain the ultimate reason why it was that Check 21 failed. When it came back in its second incarnation, what happened is the banks that supported it realized that if they made all of these patents worthless, they would make their own future patents in this same technology space worthless as well. So what they did is they carved out an exception such that any bank which had a patent in this particular area would be able to get full patent protection. It was just the outsiders who would get nothing. And so at that time, it really looked not only like a terrible piece of property legislation, but kind of like a cartel creation device, because if nobody else gets a return on their new patents, it's only left to this small group of banks to do all the innovation, and that would not be desirable. Once we beat that back, what happened is they said, well, we can't get this substantively. Can we find a way to do it procedurally? And it turns out that Section 18 that you referred to of S23 was, in fact, designed largely to deal with the data treasury patents. There may have been others out there that people were concerned about, but these are extremely valuable patents because the imaging technology is so pervasive and so valuable. And what they did, is in effect, is they gave you a couple of situations and outs. One is that you get a reexamination before the PTO if you're a party who was aggrieved and lost in some judicial system. And what happens is that now gives rise to two kinds of objections, both of which, in fact, go absolutely into orthodox lines. The first of them is, you know, we've got a final judgment against Mr. X, and now Mr. X can turn around and open this thing up inside the PTO. What happens is that's a taking, because res judicata essentially determines the title is between the two parties. And if you now go get a second crack at the apple for no particular cause, you're doing something that nobody can do with respect to land. In the land context, if you're allowed multiple challenges to a single title, that would surely count as a taking because the original one is no longer going to be there. And that's the way the laws work there. That's the way the law should work here. And the second element has to do with separation of powers. In the ordinary situation, it's a pretty strong set of authorities that adjudication of particular disputes when done in the judicial branch are final judgments, and the legislature cannot interfere with the particular cases, even though it may be able to change the general rule going forward under which that case was decided. And now, all of a sudden, what you're doing is you're saying you could bring these things back in there. And so the question is, why on heaven's name would you want to allow the legislature to set up its own administrative tribunal and negate the jurisdiction of Article III courts? There are some patent cases which seem to allow that, which I don't think are very well reasoned, but the more general propositions in the Supreme Court are pretty emphatic about that. And then third, you get yourself a set of due process evaluation issues, because when you go into these patent courts, it's the head of the patent tribunal who gets to pick the particular judges who sit on individual cases. There's no randomness with respect to assignment and so forth. And one could really argue that that just opens up the field to bias in a way that you don't get when there's a random selection of judges in an Article III court. So the point about the whole AIA is that these provisions ought to be challenged and, in my view, ought to be thrown out. But the key thing here to remember is that when you talk about the patent laws being part of the whole system, it's not just a question on the design of property rights. It also has to do with the takings law. It also has to do with separation of powers. And it also has to do with the protection that property gets under the due process clauses. It would be really terrible for somebody to come forward and argue, you know, we've just proved that patents aren't property rights. God knows what they are. But we're now going to say, since they're not property, they're not protected under due process, so you don't get any of the protections against bias and so forth. Look, we give that protections to people who get driver's licenses today, all the forms of new property. It would be very odd to say that you don't give them to the patent law. So I think, in effect, that the second-tier attack, which is not as frontal as the other one, is institutionally quite insidious because of the way in which it can undermine fundamental institutions of justice which antedated the patent law and ought to survive its implementation.
Well, this is a fantastic survey of, I think, of a lot of the fundamental issues that are at stake in some of the patent debates today. And so at this point, I'd like to open it up to our audience who are probably chomping at the bit to ask you questions about ongoing issues in the patent disputes.
Okay, thanks very much, guys. This is Dean Reuter again. Adam, should we take this first question?
Certainly.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Suppose we were to consider some possible legislative reforms and what some might be that would improve the situation, perhaps in certain types of cases. For example, instead of a 17-year exclusive right to manufacture or produce, you could have a 7-year exclusive right to produce, followed by a 10-year right of others to produce if they paid a royalty, with perhaps the royalty decreasing from, say, 50% at the beginning of the period to zero at the end of it. That would provide a mechanism by which profits could be captured initially by a monopoly on production, but which would facilitate the transition to broader production. And secondly, perhaps we need to do some tweaking as to what is patentable. In the recent Samsung via Apple case, it did seem on the face of it that some of the patents claimed seemed to me not to be patentable, but it wasn't successfully challenged in the case.
Okay, should I answer that, Adam, I guess?
Oh, yeah.
First of all, basically, John, my instinct on the first question is to go pretty much in the opposite direction, and let me see if I can explain why. First of all, if you're going to start to fragment these kinds of periods, it adds administrative cost. And secondly, the only way that you can do the second half of this is through some system of compulsory licensing. And the moment you start to do that, what you're going to introduce is vast amounts of strategic behavior, whereby what happens is that people will say, well, we have a right to take the license, and you're charging too much of it. And then you're going to have either an arbitration panel or an adjudication of some sort or another to figure out what the values are. The difficulty is that when you actually look at the system of patent licenses, they all are often a little bit different from one to another. The obvious point is that you have exclusive licenses to one party, and then it turns out that you may have non-exclusive licenses, but the non-exclusive licenses may be for different locations, different technologies, different sharing obligations, reciprocal obligations of one sort or another, so that what happens is the moment you put this statutory duty on here, you're going to have to figure out how you standardize the license relationships, and the question is, why is it worth it? Well, the first point to note is, if you actually look at the pattern with respect to many licenses, is the day that they're out there, they are used for manufacturing, perhaps by the patentee, but many of them are also put into various kinds of patent pools and are licensed out to third parties. You don't wait 7 years to do it. You do it immediately because there's an extra stream of revenue. And the question the firm asks itself is, if in fact it gives a non-exclusive license to somebody else and manufactures for itself, the revenue that it gets from the license exceed any loss in revenue it gets from operations. And to the extent that a patent could be used in two products which are not in direct competition with each other in the consumer market, generally speaking, you're going to get yourself a positive rate of return from the license, and at that point, all is going to be well. The second point about this is that in many cases, it seems to me that one should encourage these licensing organizations rather than people who basically only want a license rather than to develop themselves, because they can put together patent portfolios from large numbers of individuals, license them off, and even if they're inventing companies, what happens is if you basically make yourself into a license-only kind of operation, the great advantage that you get out of that is you don't have to have the extensive capital that it will start to create in order to have full manufacturing lines. So if you actually then start to look at the way in which the particular world starts to work, I mean, before you start talking about a licensing system which is mandated by law, you have to be extremely careful to understand the way the licenses currently operate. And my view about it is I'm much more of a freedom of contract guy on that than the current law is. And the biggest problem that you have is the one that I referred to earlier on, which is when people start making non-exclusive licenses, they may not be able to get injunctive relief against the outsiders. Clearly, any individual non-exclusive licensee is not in a good position to bring it. All of them together can't do it. And if you follow suggestions made, I think, in a most misguided fashion by Mark Lemley and others, that you deny the licensor the right to do this because it's a non-practicing entity, as we sometimes call them, that just strikes me as being a horrific danger. The rule when you have non-exclusive rights, for example, in fishing, has always been that the licensor can keep out third parties from coming inside the lake. And that's exactly the rule that I think you ought to have here. So generally speaking, keep it simple, keep it lean. If you think there's a problem, adjust the length. And the area in which this is most important today is, in fact, with respect to drugs that are covered by Hatch-Waxman or by the more recent Biosimilars Act, where, given the time that the stuff is in development and under approval, the residual time for marketing may be too small. And in pharmaceuticals, of course, the use pattern is completely different from what it is with software. A drug which is on the market for 11 years, in fact, may be much more valuable than one which just comes on the market, because you now have a large number of cases and a long period of use, so that you can do a pretty good evaluation on both effectiveness and safety risk, which you cannot do when a product first comes on the market. So sometimes you take something like Lipitor, it's quite common that the year of greatest sales is the last year under patent protection, so that extra year going out really makes the difference. And I'm willing to think about that, but I'd rather do it through the Hatch-Waxman mechanism than change the basic 17-year period. On the question of patent eligibility, I mean, on this particular issue, there is no one who can disagree with the possibility that some of these things seem to go beyond the line. The difficulty is how you want to deal with it. And essentially what the patent system does is has two basic tests. One, the eligibility test, a kind of category test. Do we allow algorithms which have physical endpoints and operating instructions to be patentable, or do we treat them as a mere mathematical formula? You know, and I think that the answer is they were made patentable in the early 80s, and it had a huge spur in medical instrumentation, which, if it's not killed by the taxes under the Obamacare bill, would still consider to be a very, very important feature in the United States. And in Kapos, the decision turned out to be, in Bielski rather, a kind of a non-event, because what they did is they said this particular patent seems to fail the non-obviousness test, but they refused to make any categorical judgments about business method patents writ large. The only thing that does make a judgment about business patent writ large is, in fact, other provisions that are contained in the America Invents Act. And what they do is they write a definition which is so uncertain that you don't know exactly whether or not something which is a business method patent for one purpose is, in fact, going to be a business method patent for another, because there's no clear lineup between the standard categorizations that are used inside the patent office and those that are used inside the statute. So generally, I'm against trying to sort of take these definitions and to tweak them. I think that you're going to get a lower level of risk and a higher level of reliability if you move in the opposite direction. And what I mean by that is basically making correct decisions on the non-obvious point rather than on the category point. And, you know, sometimes when people say these things ought not to be patentable, they also get the wrong understanding of what the patent system does. So one of the patents that I gather is in dispute is your ability to take your fingers and enlarge or contract the size of an image on the screen. And, you know, I don't think anybody should be entitled to get a patent on any process that allows you to do that particular function. But if somebody has developed a set of complicated algorithms which allows that thing to work, other people may be able to duplicate the end result, but they have to use a distinctive form of functionality. But that's been part of the patent law since Samuel Morse tried to patent all use of the spectrum for electronic communications, and that one was disallowed. Nobody remembers the device patents which were granted. It's the one that's denied that marks that case. So I think, and again, on these stories, a modest tweaking is perhaps always appropriate. If you see bad cases, that could get sensible fixes. But the other suggestion to change the durability of patents by splitting the options to the owner will certainly weaken their patent rights, and I think it will go in the wrong direction.
What about the problem of patents that are filed, but the patentee can never get financing to produce them? They sit dormant, blocking further work by others, and perhaps after 17 years, someone from China or Japan or elsewhere sits in the patent office, scarfing it up, putting it into production, and all of this happens because the potential investors are only looking for certain kinds of patents that with a high profit potential, and there is a general suppression of, let's say, lesser value inventions that would be useful for society, but that would require a lower cost of entry.
Well, I mean, I'm, again, mixed emotions. If you go back and you read the earlier case on this, the Continental Can case or whatever, was termed from 1908, one of the things that it says is that if you patent two technologies that are substitutes for one another, you can choose to develop the more promising one and need not lose your patent protection when you refuse to develop the other. And it seems to me that you have to have some particular kind of rule like that. Otherwise, what will happen is if somebody has a broad patent which has two or more applications, he is necessarily going to have to go into competition with himself, as it were, by allowing somebody to either license or just plain flat out use the other forms of the drug. So what you have to understand is that the suppression in some of the cases of one good is in fact a rapid development and improvement of the substitute technology which is also there. And I don't think anybody wants to tell a company if it's got two or more different ways to approach a market that it has to use both or to forfeit one. As to the cases where there are no complements and substitutes, which you talk about, this would be my reaction. If I have a lesser valued patent that I don't want to develop, there's no point on me sitting on this thing for 17 years and getting zero revenues. I would rather be much better off to find a way in which to make licenses of that thing or even sales of a patent, though that's much less frequently done, so that somebody else could take advantage of it. And that can go in one of two ways. It can be that you say, here I have this technology. If somebody wants to develop it, we'll have a combined agreement. I'll contribute the patent and get a certain revenue. You'll contribute other stuff and get more. And then if it turns out that you actually have some technology to go along with the patent, you can change the deal in the joint venture. And the other thing is you could start putting these things into patent pools where their complementarities with other patents may enhance the value of both of them and do that through voluntary means. But to simply assume that if you're not going to develop a patent that it ought to languish is, I think, a wrong thing to do, because the only time in which you're not going to basically push that particular patent is because pushing it in one particular case will reduce the overall stock and value of the rest of your holdings. And if that takes place, there's no, discordance or disjunction between the social welfare function and the private welfare function. The way in which you're going to make money in this case is to give opportunities to use those things that are worth developing, and in some cases you'll do it directly, in other cases you'll do it by joint venture, in other cases you'll do it by pooling. So I think that the question kind of presupposes a lack of understanding on the part of market players as to how these things work. And whenever I speak to them, which is not all that often, they pride themselves on their ability to ring the last valuable dollar out of a suite of patents. Because as they say, you know, we're in this market, we got a wasting asset. Sitting on this thing and getting zero revenues is not very nice. And if, in fact, the registration is clear and the patent is weak, other people can invent around it. So we're sitting on a depreciating asset whose value will be increased if we could find a way through complementarities to get it actively into the marketplace so that people can use it, explore it, improve it, and so on.
Excellent. Dean, are there any other questions from the audience members?
We do have another question. We have one more question at this point. Before we go to the next question, let me announce that next week we're going to be hosting a teleform calls on Hosanna Tabor, the unanimous U.S. Supreme Court decision on the ministerial exception, and an update on the crisis pregnancy center litigation. The Hosanna Tabor call will be Monday, next Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The crisis pregnancy center litigation update is next Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, both at this same number. And let's go to our next caller.
Hello, Professor Epstein. My name is Matthew Rackety. I'm a 1L at Pace Law School. My question is really simple and straightforward. I'm going to probably spend the next 3 years learning all about everything that you just surveyed. But I'm curious, to what extent would you say it is of value to look at the current patent system as facilitating a sort of a market system whereby you have basically a pricing mechanism on ideas and inventions that allows for innovation? So this speaks to, I think, what you're getting at with the cross-licensing and patent pools and so on. To what extent should we be kind of articulating that model for defending the current system insofar as kind of countering the idea that weakening the current system will be a spur for innovation, whereas having basic pricing will actually be the real innovative factor?
Well, I'm on your side. I mean, one of the things, of course, that's so striking about the critics of the current patent system who call for the abolition of it is that oftentimes they say the reason why we want to get rid of software protection, for example, or business method protection, is that we think the market does a far better job in organizing the assembly of resources than does the patent system. So their conception of what a market is and what a market does is really quite different. They treat essentially the patent system as a blockage so that people cannot essentially put together their own teams, their own ideas, and their own ingenuities. Now, there is obviously some truth to that proposition, because if it weren't, then we'd allow everything to become patentable. It's quite clear we don't allow the patents of general mathematical formulas and natural substances, at least in their natural state and so forth, and we don't allow the patenting of ideas or their protection by the copyright laws. Because the simple understanding that we have is those things are going to be generated in large numbers wholly without regard to a patent protection system. So to give, for example, somebody the patent over a new word that they create or even a trademark over it is going to be a mistake unless it's a brand which is designed to sell a particular subject matter. So you'll protect Google insofar as it refers to a particular company, but you're not going to protect it if it becomes a verb and somebody says, well, we have to Google this information on some online site. And it's, you know, pretty hard to figure out where it is that the intellectual property protection begins and where it ends. But what I think is equally clear is that although there are some cases in the middle where you can develop an anxiety attack as to how far the protection goes, in the end, you say the same thing with respect to intellectual property that you said with respect to land. You could never say with respect to land that we need to do is to abolish private property and land in order to allow the market to work, because what will happen in that so-called market is there'll be an immense amount of confusion as everybody tries to occupy the same land at the same time. And if you go back to the old agricultural metaphors, they said only those who a reap should be able to sow, or a sow should be able to reap, that is, you can only collect what you produce. And if you don't give long-term property interest, you'll never get the market together, because the people who put the seed in the ground will not be the ones to harvest the grain when as and if it comes up. And I think there's a lot of problem about that in the patent system. Unless you give protection, you're not going to have people coming with technologies to the table. So you need a kind of a mixed solution in which certain things are subject to protections, other things are put into the public domain immediately, other things like generic drugs and so forth go into the mix after a certain period of year. And I think the burden is on those, given the rate of progress that we've seen over the last years, to think that the system that we have is so misguided that you ought to scrap it. I don't know if you realize this, but back in the early, late 70s and early 80s, the patent system was a good deal weaker than it is now. starting in 1980 with a case called Chakrabarty, where they said you could patent a living organism, that it fell within the categories. Indeed, you could patent anything under the sun, is what the decision said. There was an enormous advance in the amount of stuff that took place. There was a real incentive that drove the creation of new technologies. And that kind of gives you a rough and ready test of the fact that the first part of what Adam put as the great trade-off, that is the incentive part of this thing, is not to be belittled simply because commercialization is easier in a world in which all of the relevant conceptions are in the public good. And in fact, one of the reasons that we like this current balance is that it's kind of cooperative. You put a new kind of drug on the market, it has to compete with the generics of older drugs. And that means, in effect, not only does it have to be better than the older drugs, it has to be better than the older drugs by an amount which justifies the rather substantial price differential between the two kinds of products that are going to be out there. And this, in fact, means that the generic competition now heavily influences the way in which people strategize on what particular new products are going to be in there. See, take a drug like allopurinol, which is very good in dealing with uric acid and with gout. This thing has been in generic form in 55 years, and there's been no new patented drug that wants to take that exact space, because it turns out the relatively simple structure of this molecule seems to work extremely well over the long haul, and you don't get innovation there. But when it starts coming to various other kinds of things, even, for example, things like the statins, which deal with high blood pressure, it is amazing how much people are willing to pay for small differences, because they perceive them as having large consequences in the world at large, in the way in which they're administered, in the way in which they interact with other drugs, the side effects, the tolerance that they have. Generally speaking, if you've got two different drugs, there will not be uniform acceptability of the drugs to all people in the potential joint space. Some will do better on one and some on the other. So, for example, with Vioxx off the market, there are many people who just don't do as well on Celebrex, and they would pay dearly to be able to get this drug back because it worked better for them. So I think, in effect, that the current system does just fine, and when you create property rights, it allows you to have markets, and then when you get rid of the property rights, as with generics, you still have markets, but of course at a fraction of the price, larger dissemination, other problems of their own, but I think the current system kind of gets it about right.
Great. I think I agree with you.
Okay.
We do have one more question. We'll take this, what for now is our final question.
This is Marianne McGrail, an attorney in Washington, D.C.
Nice to meet you, Marianne.
Yes, we've met before. In fact, I helped write the Hamdan brief. My question is, how effective do you think the U.S. patent system has been and is in permitting enforceability of U.S. patents abroad, in particular in China and India?
Oh, my God. Now, there is a really tough question. And, you know, my first thing is to plead it's outside my scope of jurisdiction. And then having said that, let me see if I can give you an answer, which is best I can tell. The questions about foreign enforcement with respect to patents gives rise to a completely different set of issues from the one that we've been talking about here. Whether you're talking about patents or copyrights, when you start having mass violations with respect to what's going on, almost invariably, the question of whether or not there is or is not an infringement is not really one that's worth working about. So if it turns out that you've got a patent on a certain kind of device and somebody just copies the thing literally, it's been adjudicated as valid everywhere in which it goes, the only thing that you're worried about is whether you could catch the son of a gun. What you're not worried about under those circumstances is whether you've got patent validity. And the kinds of questions that you have to face in order to do that are completely different from the conceptual questions that I've talked about here. And so one of the big difficulties you have in enforcing foreign patents is making sure that you could get access as a foreigner into the domestic courts of a place like China, or whether they're going to provide you a forum, say, in Hong Kong, which would allow you to adjudicate those claims so that you think you could overcome what many people regard as a wall of resistance against American patents being enforced against China by Chinese companies. Or, on the other hand, if the company that infringes turns out to have an international presence, can you attach their assets in some third company like the UK where they do business in order to punish them for what they've done there, which raises all sorts of additional questions as to whether or not, when you don't have a judgment, you could bring an action in the first instance in a place where the violation itself has not taken place, where, in fact, the jurisdictional ties of China to the British system or the UK is really very, very weak. So what has to be done under those circumstances is to engage in a combination of trade wars on the one hand, which are highly dangerous, and treaties on the other. And what the trade wars start to say is, unless you protect our patents on your side, we're not going to protect something that you want in our particular country. And, of course, the two things are never perfectly complementary. So if they don't enforce your patents and you keep their olives out of the United States, it turns out that you just spread the war rather than confining it, and people become exceedingly nervous about that. Or what you do is you negotiate on behalf of the United States a treaty that will protect any and all local individuals in the way in which they are supposed to work. And that becomes, of course, a very different kind of problem. Now, how successful has it been? I think the answer is less so, and will become a little bit more so as these countries start to mature. What's the dynamic? Well, for one thing, guys that have no patented stuff don't mind running roughshod over a patented system. But the moment the Chinese start developing some real values, the retaliations become much more powerful. And the same thing, of course, is true with respect to India, where, for example, the generic pharmaceutical industry is really in very, very good shape. But the Indians have basically discovered that they've paid a pretty high price. There was a large amount of anti-foreign sentiment which animated many of their local rules on investment and so forth about 6 to 9 months ago, resulting in precipitous drops to the level of foreign investments in India. These things, in effect, then really had very bad local consequences in all sorts of ways, and the recent efforts on the part of the Indian Parliament has been to reverse direction to become a little bit less protectionist. So the way to understand all of the patent stuff is the way in which the international negotiations have gone. It's part of a large mosaic, and indeed, as we well know, if you look at the Doha agreements and so forth, a lot of the struggle in this area is patent protection and how do they work with underdeveloped countries. And they say, we'll give you patent protection if you give us agricultural relief, which we should give them in any event because we're so anti-free trade in this stuff, that what you're doing is you're looking at a very different class of problems with a very shaky future. And the guys who are technicians in the patent law who litigate in the United States system are not the people who would go as a first approximation to handle patent protection overseas. It's going to be the international trade people of one kind or another and the diplomatic types who are going to have to take over that particular battle.
We have one final question if we want to take this question. We still
have Let's just get to the top of the hour and then call it a day.
Here we go.
A lot of the topics that we've been skirting around and touching on briefly have involved software patents and the Apple-Samsung dispute and the patents at issue in there. And, of course, there's a tremendous amount of litigation currently right now over software patents, over smartphones in the high-tech industry generally. To what do you attribute the increase in litigation? There's not a patent litigation explosion. The statistics show that the rates generally remain the same, but there has been a significant rise of litigation in particular pockets of industries. And what significance do you think this has?
Well, boy, I'd have to know a lot more than about these industries on a day-to-day basis than I do. But here are a couple of explanations. I mean, you take something like the smartphone industry and just think about the total amount of dollars that are connected with it today in 2012, even to what it was 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, there was a time when most people thought it was a kind of a nice extra to have a cell phone. Then people thought it was really nice to have one, and you probably had to. And now as I go around, I see people, they've got 2 or 3 of these devices in front of them, and they're wheeling and dealing with them. So that the market penetration has been very, very high. The rate of innovation has been paradoxically very high. So that what you do is you get rapid innovation and substitution. Most people, when I went by to buy my new phone, which was a Samsung phone, they didn't have the Apple in stock, and God knows what I would have done then. I asked the guy at AT&T, I said, what's the average rate of replacement of phones? And he says, most people do it within 18 to 24 months. So, you know, if you're talking about a base of 100 million telephones in the United States and a depreciation rate like this, plus new people coming into the market, this is just a huge market. And huge markets means that all the patent disputes are now larger, which means there's now more of an incentive to litigate because litigation expenses on average tend to go up less than the amount in dispute. The other thing I think which does it is less optimistic. I think the weakness on the rules with respect to injunctions has created a willingness on people to try to take their chances, deviate, and then let somebody be sued because the less powerful remedy invites the higher level of breaches. And, you know, so under that particular point, you'd also predict it. Now, are there other features that are involved in this situation? I don't know, but if it turns out that there is a kind of general intellectual climate, as there surely is in the United States, which says, you know, these patents are presumptively bad unless shown to be good, what you're going to find will happen is there's a greater willingness to sue because all of the odds that people are going to calculate on this soft stuff are going to basically say returns from litigation have increased. So in an odd sense, the doomsday may create a self-fulfilling prophecy. And on that note, I see we're coming to 4 o'clock, and I will call this to a merciful end. Thank you so much, Adam, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Richard. Dean?
Well, let me thank you both, Professors Adam Mossoff and Richard Epstein, for joining us today and sharing your thoughts with us. To the audience, thank you for joining us as well. I hope you'll join us for our next Teleform conference call Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time as we discuss the Hosanna Tabor case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.